Hello, I am Richard Booker. I'm a haematologist in the West Midlands, England, and this is Don't Just Read the Guidelines. Don't Just Read the Guidelines is a podcast that explores ideas and research at the cutting edge of medicine, especially anything to do with blood. I aim to provide a platform to incredible people you probably haven't heard from before and share their work, ideas, and opinions. We will take you beyond the guidelines and into the research behind them. And most importantly, into the sticky world of opinion and conjecture. You can subscribe to this podcast on your preferred platform. And don't forget to leave a review, as it really helps others to find the show. If you would like to come on the podcast or know someone else who would be great, please find me on Twitter, at Richard Booker. My guest on this episode is Jane Rutherford. Jane is a specialty haematology doctor up in Inverness, Scotland, working for NHS Highland and covering NHS Western Isles. I came across Jane after BSH this year when she emailed me, and we started talking about how there can be extreme challenges but also extreme reward working in such a beautiful yet rural and difficult location. She covers a massive area encompassing 355,000 patients as a team of five haematology consultants and her. This is such a really interesting and fun interview, and I really hope that you find it as fun and interesting as I did to record. If you are interested in going up to work in Inverness, it sounds like a great place to work and a great place to learn, and I've put Jane's email in the information to the episode so that you can get in touch with her. I would highly recommend considering doing that, and it's something that I would love to do too if I can drag my wife and kids up there at some point in the next few years, which is probably going to be a challenge, but we can all but dream. Anyway, sit back and relax and enjoy the next half hour of conversation with Jane Rutherford. Hi, welcome back to Don't Just Read the Guidelines. It's so lovely to be joined by Jane Rutherford. Hello, Jane, all the way from Inverness.
Hi there, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And I was so chuffed that you got in touch with me after BSH to be involved in Rapido, which is a shameless plug for the project that I'm running through Heemstar. But I thought, well, we've got this lovely haematologist up in Inverness, and it sounds like a really, really interesting place to work. And he told me a few really funny stories about how you do rural haematology. I thought this is such a good opportunity to get someone on to talk about this and possibly act as a bit of an advert for you guys as well to perhaps recruit some staff. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great place to work. So hopefully in this podcast, I can convince people that it's a good place to come up and see.
Yeah, definitely. So where exactly do you work and what do you cover? Or tell me what your job is first.
Yeah, so I'm a specialty doctor in haematology in Raigmore Hospital. And Raigmore Hospital is in the city of Inverness, so the most northern city in Scotland. But we cover the entirety of NHS Highlands as well as NHS Western Isles. And that actually also includes a further four hospitals. So that's Belford down in Fort William, Western Isles Hospital in Stornoway, the Wick Hospital up in Caithness, and also the Broadford, which is in Skye. So we really cover five hospitals, but we base out of Inverness.
Okay. So that's a massive geographical area, isn't it?
It's huge. So I think it's the biggest health board in the UK. It's colossal, and it's a challenging geography to cover. We have a population of about 320,000, and it's across a huge area, very mountainous, a lot of single track roads, as you can imagine, and also a lot of islands. That's part of the kind of logistical challenges of doing remote and rural haematology. Okay.
And are you from Inverness?
No, I'm actually from the south. So I'm from Glasgow.
Okay. So what attracted you to work in Inverness, given the difficulties of the actual job?
Well, a lot of things, actually. I was working in haematology in Christchurch in New Zealand, and I was moving back to do my CMT training. And I was swithering about where to do that. And really, I just heard kind of glowing reports about Raigmore Hospital from medical students who'd been there for placements, but also colleagues who'd worked there for other parts of their training. Mm-hmm. And they said it had been a really lovely hostel to work in, great training opportunities, and a really friendly place as well. So that attracted me. And as well as that, I love the outdoors, the idea of being able to leave the front door of the hostel on your road bike and go cycling to some lochs and doing some open water swimming or heading up some hills straight after work really appealed. So it was part of the training, knowing you'd be in a friendly DGH, and also the kind of availability of the outdoors right on your doorstep.
Okay. And was that sort of friendliness and what you were told, is that all true?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a really, really friendly hospital. Obviously, I've done my CMT training here and now I'm working in haematology. Really, the whole hospital works as a team. Yeah. And it's the same in haematology. You know, we're all generalists, but all have kind of special interests and areas. We all cover each other's patients and we all really help each other out. But that's the same in the hospital. You know, you call somebody up and everybody knows everybody. Everybody's really willing to really go the extra mile for patients, because chances are that patient is the nurse's great granny or whatever. And everybody's kind of connected in certain ways. So, no, it's a very friendly place to work. Yeah.
Okay. How big is it? I mean, how many haematologists have you got? And tell me a little bit about the A&E and things. Is it a trauma centre?
So I guess it's technically, yeah, it's a trauma centre for the whole of the Highlands. If there is anything that, you know, major happens out on the roads and helicopters are called in, patients will get transferred to usually Glasgow,
right,
or Aberdeen, depending on locality. From a haematology point of view, at the moment we've got six consultants, and then myself as a specialty doctor, okay, and then we've got two advanced nurses, and that covers the whole of the Highlands. Yeah.
Okay. And does everyone do everything, or do you have sort of subspecialties?
So all of us do everything, but you know, one of the consultants got a special interest in kind of coag and pregnancy related haematology.
Okay.
One of them's got kind of myeloma, the other's AML, etc. So we all have our own areas of interest, but because we do the on-calls and cover everything, we really just do everything as well.
Okay. Sort of on a day-to-day basis, how does this differ from working in sort of a city hospital? Because presumably your patients don't sort of come to clinic from Stornoway and various places. Is it a lot of remote sort of virtual stuff?
Yeah, it varies quite a lot, actually. So I think a lot of things went more kind of over what we have as near me and telephone consultations with COVID. But to be honest, before that, we were already doing that a lot.
Yeah.
And like you say, you're not going to drag someone for a 8-hour round trip from Sky for their monthly lenalidomide check, and like say lots of our patients on the islands really don't want to make that journey on the boat as well, so you try and kind of tailor it to each patient and what they're willing to do. Okay. So day to day our clinics are quite a mixture, especially, you know, with trials, especially the radar trial, patients have to be seen face to face. So we do have a patient on that trial in the Western Isles who comes over every 3 weeks to see us. It's quite an undertaking, but they're very motivated and keen. And if they want to do that, then we'll support that and help them with all their transport and accommodation.
What's the radar trial?
Sorry, it's kind of it's one of the myeloma trials going on at the moment. So it's for kind of first line treatment for myeloma, and looking at isotuximab kind of upfront and also in maintenance therapy as well. So I think most of the centres in Scotland are involved in that. But yes, it does involve needing face-to-face appointments every 3 weeks. But like I say, some of our patients are very, very motivated and happy to do the travelling. But our clinics are a big mixture of near-me's, telephones and face-to-faces. And we have a lot of patients come in face-to-face from far away for transfusions and their chemo and things like that.
So I was going to ask, is you sort of your sort of day patient chemo, things like R-CHOPs and transfusions, have you got a hub? Is this sort of a hub and spoke, or do they have to come all the way from Sky to you?
Nope. So the Sky is fantastic. So all these other peripheral centres that I mentioned, the other four hospitals, they all give chemotherapy. They can all transfuse blood and platelets, and they all have inpatient beds. So they can support a lot of the things that our patients need locally, which is great. Okay. So it's really good. Yeah.
So I guess that offers sort of logistical challenges, specifically with, a chemo definitely that goes off pretty quickly, but also transfusions and stuff. I mean, platelets, there's a great story about platelets. Just tell me how you get platelets to these hospitals.
Yep, so we only keep platelets in Raigmore. So if people need platelets anywhere else across the Highlands, then we need to kind of pre-order them up from Edinburgh, and kind of make sure that obviously all the samples are up to date, and then get them on the van out. So that can be, yeah, logistically challenging. And I know I told you a story last time, which I think really tickled you. And it was basically about one of our patients who lives on quite a remote island on the Western Isles, and for a period of their treatment, they needed quite a lot of platelet transfusions to kind of support them through that period in their treatment.
Which island was this? Sorry.
I'm trying to actually remember. I think it's something like one of the USs that they were on, but
Okay.
it's not particularly close to Stornoway, unfortunately. And not all the islands have flights that go into them either. There's a few small airports across it, but it makes it more challenging. So to deliver the platelets, then we were trying to work out, well, is there a way to get the flight in with them? Is there, how do we get them down on these specific days? Because, get the blood samples, we actually have to review the patients, prescribe them, get the platelets there on time. And the most reliable mode of transport between the hospitals to get the platelets delivered and driven down to the patient transpired to be the laundry van that actually was the most reliable mode of transport. Going 2 to 3 times a week, not the pharmacy van, not any other kind of vans, the hospital laundry van. So we would get the platelets all parceled up nice and safe, popped in the back of the laundry van, and popped down to the patient. And because obviously the roads are single track, a few potholes kept the platelets nice and agitated and nice and safe on the way down to the patient. And it meant that, yes, is it slightly unconventional? Yes. But did it mean that our patient got the treatment that they needed in a safe way and could support them being at home and still, not having to come to the mainland? Yes. And so as much as it was a wee bit logistically challenging at first to organise it, afterwards it ran very smoothly, and it was a success for the patient. So yeah.
Do you have to sort of chain the laundry van driver and things to be able to sign for platelets and blood products and things?
Well, I think it's because there was people at each end who could sign for it, so it was okay. But he knew he had slightly more precious cargo to look after.
Oh, that's fantastic. And do you know, like these patients, if they obviously you can't perhaps always conform to guidelines and be do sort of perfect medicine. Do you feel like you kind of drop your standards a little bit, or you sort of have to accept that patients aren't going to get maybe protocolized care, but there's always this balance between sort of the practicalities of it and the best you can do. Or do you manage, do you not bring that into your thought process, and do you just try to be as good as you can, or how does that work?
Yeah, I can I totally understand the question, and I think it's always a balancing act. And I think you probably have to actually think about that no matter where you work. I think especially when you think about at the moment in the NHS and bed pressures and staffing, I think a lot of us feel like, are we doing the job to the best of our abilities because of staffing and resources, etc. And maybe it's slightly more apparent in remote and rural settings because those challenges have always been there, but we are good at kind of managing them. I don't think we have to drop our standards at all. I think we deliver really good care up in the Highlands. I think what we need to do though is be able to think on our feet, think outside the box. And actually, we always try and make sure that our patients get the best possible care, but it's just about having to sometimes really think about how we do that. And it's also about, like say, sometimes about compromise, but most of the time we can think our way around, and it's like extra things that we can do, sometimes extra things the patients can do, and they're usually pretty willing. I mean, I remember one day before work, this lovely patient coming over from Skye who we're trying to sort of pick line out for and platelet transfusions beforehand, and she was at accommodation and couldn't actually get transport at that time in the morning, but I'm usually in at 7:30 or so. So I actually went and picked the patient up from her hotel. But it's not a big deal. And actually it meant that I could get her in. And you'd been building up to that point for a while to get her over from Skye. And you're not about to just throw all that away because she can't get a taxi at 7:30 in the morning. And I don't personally think that's going above and beyond. I think that's just doing the right thing by your patients. But I think we still are able to deliver really, really good care. I don't think we compromise, but I think we are flexible in the way in which we manage things that crop up.
And I guess a lot of things like chemotherapy regimens quite arbitrary, aren't they? You know, R-CHOP every 3 weeks is kind of it's an arbitrary thing that was based on, you know, an arbitrary decision in a trial, and we all have to kind of stick to it. So I always wonder, you know, I mean, I think there was a trial, wasn't there, where they looked at R-CHOP 14 versus R-CHOP 21. Didn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that if you have to delay things by 3 days or 2 days here and there, it probably doesn't make any difference to people's outcome.
Yeah, and I have to say, we're in terms of kind of needing to delay patients' treatment, it's very, very unusual for us to have to delay it because of getting the chemotherapy to the patient, or it's really always based on, well, actually, you're still profoundly neutropenic, or you're clearly still very, very unwell, or you're not coping with the side effects, we'll give you an extra week off. It's more always clinical decisions. And like I say, if we find that it's because that blood test didn't get there on time, or we don't have up-to-date full blood count, or there's issues with near me connections, you know, our delivery, you know, there's always a way around it. So it's very unusual for us to have to compromise on timings in the Highlands.
I mean, some of the patients must live in such remote places that you mentioned not being able to get flights and things. I think you mentioned to me before about people living on sort of tidal islands where they can only get in and out at certain times. Does that become a problem for some patients?
Yeah, it can do. And I think when we have patients in very remote settings, and like say accessibility is a problem, it's really important to kind of have that, like a really informed discussion with the patient, because we've had this patient out on a tidal island, so they can only get on and off during certain times. We also had a patient who lived on not on an island, but a very remote peninsula on the west coast of Scotland, and actually the only way to get in and out is by boat or by walking. And you know, he was getting treated with R-CHOP, and actually you think about, you know, if you become neutropenic, if you get side effects, do you understand the risks associated with the treatment? Do you understand the risks of living here? And as long as patients are well informed and understand that, yes, there would be a delay in them getting help. If they became unwell, there could be delays in other things. As long as they're well informed, it's fine. And again, you find when you look after people in these really remote communities, you're not just treating the patient, you're treating the whole community, because that person might run the only shop within 20 miles of all these people. Okay. That person might be the local teacher, that person might be, you know, the local police officer, and actually you're looking after that whole community, and them becoming unwell affects such a wider group of patients. And they really band round that individual. So there's like community vans that run purely on volunteer basis from really remote places in Skye and the West Coast. And they drive patients back and forth to their appointments all the time. So there's fantastic kind of community spirit. So yes, these remote places do cause challenges. But I think on the flip side, there's so much positivity that comes out from looking after people in these remote communities.
There must be patients that you can think of who you just have nightmares about, though.
Yeah, probably. I'm trying to think of one off the top of my head.
Patients that must be sort of profoundly thrombocytopenic or something, who are crofting or
working. Oh yeah, 100%. We've got a really you know, I think the population of the Highlands are hardy people, and there is a big population of crofters on the Western Isles, but really all over the Highlands. And absolutely, people on chemotherapy, people with ITP, and or people who are very, very high infection risk, and they're out there in the fields with their cows and sheep and doing all sorts of things that they know they shouldn't be. And again, you do, there's a few that definitely do end up coming in with some scrapes from crofting, and you just go, you know, you shouldn't have been doing that, but they just say, well, I want to get on with my life in between the appointments, and I know I've got this condition or disease, but you know, you don't want to be defined by it, and they've still got to make, you know, a living, and also they love it, so they don't want to stop it. But yeah, definitely there are a few patients who, you know, are going to probably get into a few scrapes and a few problems, and they will not call the cancer treatment helpline or get help. They'll wait till the last possible moment to get help. But it's very easy to recognise them. They're usually chaps in their 60s who are wearing their welly boots into the clinic. So,
okay. Which patient keeps you up at night worrying?
How long have you got?
As long as you like.
Well, yeah, I think it's the crofters, the slightly more elderly chaps who are stoic and don't seek medical help. The ones who are high risk for infection, high risk for bleeding, and who always don't want to bother their doctor. But they're also very lovely patients to look after, and they do listen to you, but it can be challenging, and you do worry about them because they can get themselves into pretty bad scrapes sometimes, out with the cows.
Do you feel like you sort of treat them differently? Do you safety net them? If you've got someone with ITP in remission, would you let them have some thrombopag, or would you have sort of a safety net course of steroids, or the guys with antibiotics who are immunocompromised? Do you have sort of have more or lower threshold to give them some prophylaxis or something like that?
There are some patients, again, there's some patients who, when they're getting the R-CHOP, we kind of automatically give them G-CSF. And again, sometimes that's partly based on clinical decision, but also you think, goodness, they are really far away from help. And actually, can we reduce the risk of neutropenic sepsis in this patient by giving them PEG? There are some patients that, again, if you're kind of trying to assess them over near me, again, we are incredibly fortunate with the absolutely fantastic GPs that we have in the Highlands. Again, they go above and beyond for patients. So, it's very easy for us to contact GPs and say, look, could you check in on this chap over the weekend? Or, I'm not going to be able to get the delivery of antibiotics out to him just in case he needs it for this kind of cut on his hand that he's got on the croft. Can you maybe get that sorted for them? So there are probably some patients that you take into their geographic location and perhaps their ability to hurt themselves as well or get into scrapes. We tend to not give out kind of pred and L-thrombopag for the ITP lot, but I think more with the kind of immunosuppressed chemo patients, we're more likely to give PEG G and probably give them some safety antibiotics if they seem like they could be brewing something and try and nip it in the bud quite quickly.
Do you have many haemophiliacs?
Yeah, we do. We've not got huge numbers, and a lot of them are actually more in the pediatric clinics at the moment, but there's some that are moving further up. We do have mostly heme A's. We've got, I think, about a very, very small number, maybe like four heme B's, and plenty of von Willebrand's. But again, they actually tend to, we don't see a lot of them because they're very well controlled on their factor. We've got one patient who does tend to get himself into some more scrapes, but he loves the outdoors, and again, you're not going to tell him to not enjoy the outdoors.
It's all about that balance, isn't it? And talking of the outdoors,
Absolutely.
presumably the weather has quite a lot of a role in some of this as well. Do you feel like
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, Scottish Highlands, I think most of us are probably quite aware that the snow can come in pretty quick. Have you had some real problems with the weather?
It does definitely play into your thoughts when you're trying to get things out to patients, especially in the winter months. Inverness has actually got very nice weather. It's a wee bit rainy, but not as bad as the west coast of Scotland. But in the winter, we get really fantastic snow. So if you're into your skiing and your ski touring, it's a great place to come in the winter to the Cairngorms. But you can appreciate there's plenty of our patients who live very remotely on single track roads that don't get gritted, and some patients do get routinely trapped in their houses over the winter months. They're completely able to cope with that. That's not a problem, but it's in terms of getting blood tests, getting connectivity with the internet as well, if you're wanting to follow them up, and then delivery of medications is a big one. And obviously, if they birth to become unwell and access there. So sometimes that can be challenging in the winter months, for sure. And some patients, ultimately, we just cannot get to them, or they can't get their bloods, or you can't get the treatment to them. So you have to kind of wait till they dig themselves out of their 12-mile long single track road to get to the nearest GP practice. And occasionally we have to take into account kind of like the flights and the ferry. The ferry between the Western Isles and the mainland is 2.5 hours long across the Minch, which is very well known for having high winds. And can be a wee bit rough. It's unusual for the flights to get cancelled, but the winds can get quite strong, so occasionally ferries and flights can be cancelled, but it happens infrequently. It's actually more a patience in the west and in Skye, where you can get really heavy snowfall around the Cairn Gorms. But again, we try to work around it, but sometimes there's just no way to get people out of kind of several feet of snow.
Do you find, like, I mean, a few questions, but one is, who pays for all the travel? I mean, that sounds pretty expensive for some of these patients.
Yeah, it can be. And I think that's always quite a worry for patients. I know that patients are expected to pay so much per journey, as it were. And then when it gets above a certain amount, we pay, as the NHS, pay for it.
Okay.
Again, for patients coming, if that's driving, but if patients are coming from the Western Isles, we basically pay for their flights or their ferries.
Okay.
And if patients are going elsewhere to say Glasgow, Aberdeen, etc., for their transplants, and they have to have accommodation, we help with that. And we also have patient accommodation on site in Raigmore, which is free. So if they're having to come over, you know, the day before and stay the following day, we sort all that out. And we've got we're very, very lucky. We've got a cancer support worker in our department, and she's non-clinical. So she basically coordinates all transport, accommodation and kind of non-clinical queries like appointment times and things like that for our patients.
Okay.
So she's a really great kind of person to help coordinate that stuff. But generally, most of it is covered by the NHS for the travelling.
Okay. I remember when I went to Skye, and it's a beautiful place. If people haven't been to Skye, it's just stunning. And we had one of the nicest days of weather. And then a year later, we went back and it was biblical. But anyway, the first time we went, we met this girl called Emma Jane. And she worked in the Talisker Distillery. And then we went to the pub the night and she was working there. And I think we saw her again. In the end, we had a chat with her when she was waiting. And she says, I've only ever been off Skye once. And she went to Aberdeen and she didn't like it. And I think she'd been to the is it Gaelic or Gate? I can never remember. It's Gaelic College, isn't it?
Gaelic, yeah.
She'd been to the Gaelic College in Skye, and essentially she'd never really been off the island apart from once. And that makes me think, during our conversation, these guys that are, you know, they get AML and need a transplant, presumably going to Glasgow for a transplant is sort of almost like going to a different country, isn't it? It's such a world away, both geographically and culturally. And I imagine for a lot of those patients, it's like the first time they've ever left their island. Do you have any insight into sort of the psychological impact of doing that? Because that's a massive deal. I mean, we have patients in Stoke who have to go to Birmingham, and it's like 35 miles or 40 miles. And that, for them, that's a world away. But for these guys, that's traumatic, surely.
Yeah. And like you say, it's culturally very different. Like, I'm obviously originally from Glasgow, and I am, you know, I love living in the Highlands, and I can never imagine leaving the Highlands now. But they are two very, very different places. You're absolutely right. You know, I worked on Stornoway in the Western Isles for 4 months during my CMT block, and I met some people who only spoke Gaelic, and they were, you know, in their 80s and 90s, and they were still crofting. And again, having their sister or one of the nurses translating for you. And there are patients I have met who will not leave the island, and they have never left the island, and they don't intend to start leaving the island.
Yeah.
So again, you have to kind of work around why that is, and if they don't want to leave, managing expectations. But absolutely, you know, there's loads of patients in the Highlands who are, you know, they will do absolutely anything, and they travel lots anyway, so it's not a big deal. But absolutely, there's some patients who, they're up in Wick, which is about a 2-hour drive north from Inverness anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, Glasgow, depending how fast you drive, is about a 3.5 to 4-hour drive from Inverness. So you're asking somebody to drive away potentially six hours or longer down the road from their family, their friends, their kind of support network, to a place that they don't know at all. It's massively busy, difficult with, you know, patients, relatives who aren't used to busy cities, and like you say, that slight culture shock as well. To a team also that, as much as we have fantastic working relationships with all the centres in Scotland, you know, they don't know the team, and I think it can be quite intimidating going to these big centres. But actually, I have to say, every patient who comes back from, whether it's their allo, their CAR-T or their auto from these centres, they just can't say, you know, speak highly enough about the centres and how well they were treated. So as much as it's a scary situation for any patient having to go off for these things, I think the centres down there are so used to taking our patients from the Highlands, and I think they also appreciate the cultural differences as well, and they get well looked after.
So how do you deal with the patients? So let's say that they've got AML, and do you do AML induction and stuff in Inverness?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So let's say they've done induction and they need an allo, and they just don't want to go. How do you sort of deal with that? I mean, have you got examples of patients who really haven't wanted to go and haven't, and you know, in a medical sort of a medical way have made the wrong decision and have suffered for it? Or do most of them sort of come around to accepting the clinical advice?
Yeah, I think most patients know that we're there to do the best by them. And, you know, I guess, you know, you're also trying to sell an allo to them. And, you know, that comes with, you know, quite a lot of pretty scary information. But I think most patients who would say, you know, we really think this is the best thing for you, and as long as you understand, you know, the risks and benefits, they're usually happy to go. But I think sometimes you can also understand, especially if people are more on that age cusp as well, and they're thinking, is this really something that I want to do? There is one particular patient who springs to mind who is not keen for an allo, and we feel that he would really benefit. And at the same time, people are entitled to their health beliefs and their autonomy in deciding what's right for them. I don't think his geography and his, you know, not wanting to travel is the problem. I think it's probably more what he's willing to accept than having to go to Glasgow. But I think most patients trust us and trust the transplant centres and are happy to take our advice. But very few of them would turn it down based on geography. And again, I find the patients who are not keen to leave islands tend to be the slightly older generation as well, people in their 70s and 80s. They don't want to leave the island to get their MRIs or their bone marrows, and they just want you to do the best care that you can by managing them entirely on the islands.
Do you ever get to go out and about?
So we do all our stuff remotely.
Okay.
But when I worked in Stornoway during my CMT, I got to go to Benbecula to do some clinics, and you have to fly there. So it was the first time I'd ever flown as a commute to get to a clinic from Stornoway to Benbecula.
Just explain to me where that is.
Okay, so so Stornoway is the when you have to drive, basically you drive from Inverness to Ullapool, that's an hour and a half, and then you get on the ferry, which is 2.5 hours to Stornoway. And then you can then fly from Stornoway to Benbecula, and that's about a 35-minute flight south. And it's, again, one of the islands that make up the Western Isles.
Okay.
It's very, very small, and it's very flat, but very pretty. Lots of kind of turquoise waters and white sands. But they run a little clinic there, usually once a month. So you get on this tiny plane. It's got two seats on one side and one seat on the other. And you go in, and they've already got a wee Tunnix tea cake sitting on each of your seats for your little flight in the morning, which is great. So when I did CMT there, I got to go out and about. Like I say, for us in haematology, because we're a smaller team covering a big area, we can't go to the peripheral sites to see patients. Yeah. And so instead, patients have to come and see us. But we can enjoy our holidays and weekends going and exploring, because everything's pretty accessible. So,
Do you feel like the team needs to be bigger? Is there funding for more haematology doctors up there?
I think probably if you asked any centre, they'd probably all say, we need more haematologists, we need more acute medics, we need more everything, and we need more funding. And I think it's the same up in the Highlands. I think the difference for us up in Raigmore is the fact that we don't have trainees. So we have, before I started working here, it was purely consultants, and then the next step would be our advanced nurses. And now I've started working here. And I think because of that, there is definitely, when you look at other centres in Scotland who get, you know, 5 or 6 registrars as well as the consultant pool, I think we definitely do have less staff, given the fact that we still cover a very large population. Yeah. So I guess it's about, with us in the Highlands and the Western Isles, it's probably about 350,000. But then you have to also take into account the geography, and that actually makes the job a little bit more challenging. And I think I said to you when we chatted before that generally for kind of remote and rural, you should get slightly more funding per patient head, as it were, to help with those logistical costs of, you know, transporting medications and chemo all over the place. And I do, I think we do need more haematologists. I think it would be fantastic if we got trainees up to the Highlands, even if it was for kind of a almost like a little taster for, you know, 6 months or a year, for people to come from maybe bigger centres and get a feel for what it's like to work in the Highlands, get that, you know, get some fresh air, get out in the outdoors, get to know the Highlands, but also work in the hospital and get a feel for the differences between what we do and the way in which we work compared to the bigger centres. And I'm sure we could probably learn a lot from them coming up to us. And I think it is something that we've spoken about a lot. And obviously, if anybody is listening and thinks, goodness, I'd love to come up to the Highlands and see what it's all about, please just directly email me, because love to hear from you. And like I say, we're a small friendly team, and we'd always love to have people come up and work for us. And if it could be part of your training or a bit out of training, it'd be fantastic.
I'll put your email in the description to the episode. What do you think would be the benefit to, let's say, a city boy, city haematologist? What would they get out of that, other than just, you know, a nice time and walks in the hills? What would that give them? What would that give them professionally, and how would that improve them as a haematologist going back to, let's say, their big centre in Glasgow?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you would learn so much. I think you would, not just clinical stuff, but I think non-clinical skills like logistics, thinking on your feet, kind of having to have those difficult conversations with patients who don't want to come to the centres, and probably conversations that you're not used to having. I think also from a clinical point of view, like, see, we don't have everything at our fingertips. We don't have flow here. So if we want flow urgently, we get it sent to Aberdeen or Glasgow. Bearing in mind, Aberdeen's a 2.5 hour drive and Glasgow's a 3.5 hour drive. Mm. We really rely on our morphology skills, on our kind of BMSs in the lab, and you have to be able to use your clinical judgment, assess that patient in front of you, and you have as much information as you can, and you treat them as you can with the available information. And it's about using your clinical skills, your morphology skills, and following the guidelines as much as you can, but also treating the patient in front of you. So I think that would develop from that side of things, and I think also the kind of the softer non-medical skills as well. And like you say, fantastic kind of work-life balance and getting out in the hills after work, so you can't complain about that.
Do you on calls, or is that all the consultants?
So the consultants all do the on calls. So because there's six of them, they do one and six, and they do overnight cover as well, which I occasionally do with one of them. But I don't do weekend cover.
Fine. So your weekends are all there for Munro bagging,
basically.
Which I believe you've finished them, have you?
Almost. There's 282 Munros, and I've done 253 now. So, you know, everyone's got to have a hobby, right? So that's what I spend my weekends doing, pottering up hills across Scotland.
And the Munros, are they all mountains over 3,000? Is that 3,000
feet? All above 3,000 feet. So not long to go. So trying to finish them off this year, and then I'll need to find a new hobby after that.
Skiing down, presumably. We touched on it before, just as a sort of a final couple of questions. We touched on it when we had chatted last week, about sort of research questions and the interest, and, you know, this is clearly a different population, and to me there's some opportunities, it's almost a natural experiment to look at the outcomes of these patients. If you could sort of come up with a few research questions you think your population could answer compared with somewhere else in the UK, what do you think they would be? What would be your priorities?
I think one big thing I'd like to look at is kind of traveling time to the nearest large centre, which really for the Highlands is just us in Raigmore, and their overall outcomes. And like I say, you could put that to any condition. You could look at outcomes in DLBCL, you know, first line, or you could look at, you know, bleeding events, or, you know, issues from ITP. And I think all of it in terms of geography and kind of time from the nearest centre would be really, really interesting in terms of patient outcomes, and whether whether they are poorer or the same as the populations that are around these larger centres. And again, I guess when you think about, okay, is the person I got the diagnosis, how long, you know, you have your intention to treat, but when do you actually start treating? Are there delays in that? And again, how can we fix that as much as you can? You're never going to change the geography of the Highlands, but are there things that we can improve on? Are there obvious things that would come from that, that we could work on and improve patient outcomes in the more remote settings? There's actually a, it's kind of just, this is anecdotal now, but there was a really interesting paper about blood product delivery in Rwanda using drones. And they basically were looking at like delivery times of blood products between different hospitals in Rwanda and also expiration of blood products. And they've basically been using this drone system for years now, and they've cut down on their blood product expirations by 67%. And some hospitals, it takes 2 hours for the blood to arrive, whereas by drone it would take only half an hour. And it made me go, that sounds quite like the Highlands. And it made me think, wow, if you could get funding for drones for certain geographical areas, that would be quite amazing for blood products, samples, as well as medications. You know, some of the medications getting delivered to patients, you know, there might only be a van once a week, and if that gets missed, they don't get medications for a week. So it made me think, goodness, what if we had drones that could just deliver it straight to the patient's house? How much that would, you know, impact on that sort of thing. But it's probably pretty expensive to implement drones across the Highlands, and I'm sure there's so much health and safety that you'd probably end up dying in the avalanche paperwork before you got any further. But
well, if it's something the Scottish government can do, if Humza Yousaf's listening, then this is a call to action.
Yeah, please. Get some
On the research thing, it's fantastic you've got patients in trials. I'm actually quite surprised by that, because you've thought sort of a rural hospital, you have other priorities. But I think it's fantastic that you're able to offer trials for patients.
Yeah, we had obviously AML18 and AML19. We had FLAIR. What other ones have we had? We've got Mithridate on the go at the moment. We've been doing RADAR for at least a year and a half, and we're about to start the Mosaic trial as well. So there's we get involved in everything that we can do, because it means that we can offer it to our patients.
I think it'd be really interesting to look across all your trials and look at the outcomes, in because the trials outcomes are so well defined and well measured. You could look at across all the trials that you guys have been enrolled in and see whether the outcomes for your patients compare with the rest of the patients, but sort of on a pan trial basis. It's just a thought. Maybe that's something
that would be interesting.
But it's certainly, there's certainly lots of food for thought. Oh, Jane, this has been really, really interesting. I would love to come up, you know, I'd love to come and come have a look at the hospital, and drag the kids and the wife up for 3 months and come and do a little placement. Maybe I need to work out how I time this in my training, but it sounds amazing. I think there's this story about, trauma and orthopedic surgeons going off to Camp Bastion for 6 weeks, and they get more experience with trauma than they would get in sort of 10 years in the UK. And it sounds, I'm not calling Inverness Camp Bastion. maybe it's as hostile for the English, but I doubt you. You're very friendly. It certainly sounds like your learning would be massively accelerated. And certainly as a junior, you know, a lot of the problems with junior training as a registrar in the UK is that you end up on the ward dealing with sick patients all the time. But it sounds like with you guys, it sounds like you're really heavily involved in the outpatient work, which I think is a really good opportunity for training, isn't it?
Absolutely. Honestly, it's a really fantastic place to work. And we would love to have you up, and like say anybody else who's listening who's interested, it'd be fantastic. It's a lovely place to live. I like to think we're a very friendly hostel, and like you say, the experience you get is fantastic. I worked mainly in outpatient, so I've been doing that for a long time, but I covered the inpatient ward. I do the lab cover as well, vet GP referrals. We also have this thing called clinical dialogue, where it's almost like a MSN with GPs, as it were, and you kind of have so they don't have to do formal referrals. You know, I do that, so every aspect of the job you're involved in. And because we're a small and very close working team, you know, you just sit next door to the office, and chat to the consultants through cases, and everybody kind of bounces ideas off. And like you say, learning's very much accelerated. You get a lot of experience, and it's a friendly place. And absolutely, if anybody wants to come up, we'd love to have people to come up, show them around beautiful Highlands and get them involved in the department, whether you want to come up for 3 months, 6 months, or a year. 100%. I think we could easily organize that for people. So please do get in touch. And yeah, Rich, if you want to come up, you just name your date, probably in the summer when the weather is good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although if you're into your skiing, we get fantastic snow in the winter. So if you want to be dragged up Cairngorm by us and over some Munros on some skis, you're more than welcome.
Sounds amazing. What a place. What a place. It's amazing. It's the same country, but it's just a world away, isn't it? Listen, Jane, this has been really cool, a real treat for me to speak to you. So thanks so much. And I think it just sounds like such a cool opportunity. If anyone is listening, honestly, really strongly consider it. And to have that combination of just accelerated learning with the amazing outdoors of Scotland is an incredible opportunity. So seriously consider it. But otherwise, we'll leave it there. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Rich.
Cheers. Don't Just Read the Guidelines is for education and entertainment only and should not be taken as medical advice. I certainly cannot guarantee the factual accuracy of any of the content, but if you do have any constructive criticism, please find me on Twitter at Richard Booker. If you like the show, please take the time to write a review on iTunes, Google, or wherever else you listen. It will really help others find the podcast. See you soon.